I know. All right. I'm on break in an hour. Meet me then. Her words gave me the first smile of my day. I had something to look forward to. Even better, it looked like the general dislike and mistrust I'd been faced with everywhere I went didn't extend all the way to Anne. I was glad about that. I made some plans and special arrangements, and by the time I met her, coming out of Blue Deck's main hatch, I had a picnic basket on my arm. She looked at it and smiled. "What have you got?" It was a long list, and there were even a few special items like pickled quail eggs and a bottle of real wine. "Where did you get all this stuff?" she asked. I pulled a few strings. She gave me an odd look. "With Turov?" My mouth opened and closed again. I was stumped. Did everyone believe I was some kind of boy toy for the brass? No, with the quartermaster. He owed me one. What kind of rumors have you been listening to? We walked together toward Green Deck as we talked. I was annoyed, but I tried to keep my voice light and unconcerned. Even I knew that yelling at your date in the first 5 minutes wasn't a man's wisest opening move. We came to the entrance, which was an overgrown arch of leafy vines. It had always looked strange as the vines were in stark contrast to the steel walls of the ship. We passed inside before she reached out and touched my arm with gentle fingers.
"I'm not being fair to you," she said. "We should cancel this."
"What? These quail eggs aren't going to eat themselves."
"I know. I appreciate all the effort you've gone to, really, I do. But I don't know if I can go through with this today."
"Oh, come on," I said. "Let's talk about it. First off, no, I didn't screw Turov to get out of being permed." Her eyes were on mine now. She didn't say anything, but I knew I had her full and undivided attention. "Secondly," I continued, "I didn't kill the Nairb ship and doom us all."
"You didn't?"
"Well, hold on," I said. "Okay, I did destroy their ship, but that's been fixed. The Galactics believe it was the squids that did it."
"How did you manage that?"
she asked suspiciously. I gave her the general story, leaving out many of the details. In my version, I was more of a secret agent sent to remove an obstacle than a crazy convict who managed to kill his executioners first.
"So,"
she said,
"that's why you're still breathing? Because Earth won't be blamed?"
"That's right. We're in the clear." Now you have to understand that I didn't know any such thing, not yet. The Nairbs were dead, and as far as anyone could tell, they hadn't reported the details of their fate. The radioactive evidence trail had been effectively planted, too, pointing a guilty finger at the squids. But the investigation hadn't come yet, and hadn't made any conclusions. To my way of thinking, I wasn't lying, but I was embellishing and extrapolating. The results I described weren't certain, but they were likely and pre-planned. When I was finished, I watched Anne to see how my words had been received. She still looked wary, like a cat that just won't come in the door because it suspects you're going to grab it the second it does. She was right. But I kept on smiling and waiting like I didn't have a care in the world. Finally, she stepped closer and took my hand. I sighed, and we found a spot to eat. Together we shared a few hours of happiness on Green Deck. No one bothered us, and we thoroughly enjoyed ourselves. Chapter 42. The only thing I hadn't gotten out of Anne the night before was a promise of more romantic encounters. She'd enjoyed herself, we both had, but she'd stopped short of making a commitment. In the morning, as I booted people out of their bunks and sent them reeling to the showers and breakfast, I was thinking of her. How was I going to entice her this time? I'd spent a lot of credits and goodwill getting that picnic together on Green Deck, but a man couldn't pull that stunt every day. For one thing, I'd be broke before the week was out. Fate had other plans for me in any case. Klaxons wailed, and we were called to battle stations at about 9 in the morning. My team was busy doing calisthenics in our module, and we didn't even have our dragons handy to jump into. "You know what that noise means," I shouted.
Move your butts, people. Everyone get down to the Dragon Bay. We're not getting caught with our pants down this time.
I knew things were bad when red arrows appeared on the deck, leading toward the lifters. I contacted Leeson immediately for directions.
McGill, the Legion Infantry is doing a hot drop. Get your dragons to the lifters pronto.
Will do, sir,
I said, waving my squad, who were pounding along behind me at a run.
What are we up against?
Unknown ships have entered the system, and they're heading for us. We're deploying Legion Varus on the Titanium Mountain with Winslade's cohort to back them up. That's all I know for now. You have your orders. Leeson out.
How many ships? That's what I wanted to know. But he was off the channel before I could ask. I relayed the information to my squad, and Sargon contacted me privately afterward.
So Solstice is going to stay in space?
He asked.
That part didn't get past you, huh?
No, Vet. The way I see it, Turov clearly has a plan, and for once, it makes a little bit of sense to me. She wants to protect her sole prize on the planet's surface, and at the same time, hold a reserve force in space so she can drop anywhere in response to an enemy attack. Our legions are only useful on the ground, so we can take it as something of a compliment that she's chosen Varus to be deployed first.
That's one way to look at it, I admitted. We'll find out what we're facing in due course, I'm sure. I'll keep you informed, Specialist.
I know you will. You're not as smooth at this job as Harris was, not yet, but I like your style, Vet.
Thank you, Sargon.
We disconnected, and I had to smile. Sargon was one of the few men in the unit who hadn't doubted me, not even when I was accused of blowing up an Imperial ship and possibly causing the eventual demise of Earth. He and I understood each other. Sometimes a man had to do what a man had to do. We were busy after that, plugging our bodies into our dragons at the same time we were decoupling them from the ship. They came to life as we moved inside them. After having piloted one of these fine machines for months now, it felt like a second skin. When I moved my arm, my dragon's long steel appendage moved. I felt like a giant made of fine metals, and that's pretty much what I was. Clanking down passages toward the lifters, we made good time. There were arrows to follow on the deck, but we knew the way by now. The ship was venting, and yellow flashes were spiraling around everywhere. It was enough to give a man a headache. The crew was scrambling just as much as the troops were. I knew what that meant. They were getting ready for some fast maneuvering. This might well be a space battle rather than a ground battle. If that turned out to be the case, my cohort might well be the lucky ones. Anyone up here could be caught and destroyed, helpless, in their dragons. When we got to the lifters, a line of bios were there waiting. They had a data system, and they demanded our data disks before we boarded. At the start of this campaign, each of us had been issued a silver disk about the size and weight of a half-credit piece. There was nothing unusual about that. What was strange was that the bios were asking for them now. I surrendered mine, and the pretty little bio put it into a slot on a data terminal. I wondered if I would get it back. But I didn't.
"Say, Specialist," I said, "what's the deal? Why are we giving up our disks to you shipboard people? Aren't we taking revival machines down to the surface with us?"
"I don't know about what equipment you'll be issued, Vet," she said. "But I know we're supposed to update everyone's data before they get on the lifters."
She proceeded to scan me then, which amounted to plugging into the data ports on my dragon, which connected in turn to my tapper. All down the line, they were stopping troops and making these transfers. It took about a minute per man, and I thought it was a little strange.
"A full body scan? Our most up-to-date data? Who ordered this?"
The specialist pointed upward at the ceiling.
"Gold deck, the very top."
Turov. It had to be her. But why? Events moved quickly after that, and I didn't have much more time to think about anything. We were hustled aboard the lifter, with me doing plenty of the hustling for my own squad. I shouted until my voice was hoarse, if only to be heard over the general din of metal-clawed feet slamming against the metal deck. Soon, we were harnessed up and set free. The lifter swooped and shifted under my feet sickeningly. The pilot knew this wasn't a drill, and she was giving it the gas. We were in open space for only 30 seconds before we hit the turbulence of the upper atmosphere. It's always hard doing a fast insertion onto a planet. You can't help but wonder if you're riding in the unlucky lifter destined to catch some flak and blow up.
But even so, it's better than being locked into a pod and fired at the surface like a cannonball, which is what was happening to the infantry. Legion Varus had an unusual number of splats that day. Heavy and light troops alike flashed down, looking like white-hot streaks in the sky. But some of their pods never opened after landing. Some punched into the hard ground like bullets, their braking jets malfunctioning. Other men had been crushed when the two halves of their capsules slammed together. Blood that boiled away and burned into a dark stain on the sides of their pods told that story. Still others screwed up, opening their emergency releases too early, too late, or even jamming them and suffocating when their minimal life support systems ran out of oxygen. Such was the lot of the infantry. Our lifter, full of dragons, screamed out of the sky like a diving eagle. I was able to watch some exterior events remotely via my tapper. It was when I looked up, craning the viewpoint around to look behind us, that I noticed something unexpected. I contacted Natasha right off. She knew things enlisted people weren't supposed to know, and I valued her opinion. "Natasha," I said, "I'm getting some strange imagery. Relay the feed." I did so, and she watched with me for several quiet seconds. The engines of Minotaur and Cyclops, the big ships we'd left behind, were flaring blue. Streaks of white gas and light stretched out behind them for a dozen kilometers. "Is that what I think it is?" I asked her. "Undeniably. The ships are pulling out. There's a full burn, and although I can't be sure, I guess they're moving to high orbit."
"Where they'll engage the warp bubbles and run?" "That's a pretty good bet, James. I'm sorry."
"Not your fault. Turov gave the order. I guess you don't have to worry about her being sweet on me anymore. If she is, she's got a strange way of showing it."
"I can't believe she's running out on us."
"How many ships are out there, Natasha?" I asked. "Do you know what's coming?" She hesitated.
"I can't be 100% sure, because the techs on the bridge who've blabbed sometimes exaggerate."
"Just tell me, how many?"
7 ships, Imperial configuration. All of them are headed our way."
I let out a breath that I hadn't realized I'd been holding. 7 ships. That's why Turov was pulling out. She wasn't even going to fight them. All of a sudden, the fact she'd dropped Legion Varus and Winslade's auxiliary cohort on the Titania mine didn't look like such a compliment. She was bailing out and leaving us behind to defend her prize alone. It was clear to me now as well why the bio people had taken our data just before we dropped. We weren't expected to survive being marooned out here. If we wiped, they wanted a good, clean copy they could use to revive us all at a safe distance. The lifter touched down, landing with a bounce that made my teeth clack together, and I began unlimbering my dragon. My grippers worked like extended hands, and I felt a certain resolve growing in my heart. We'd fight, and we'd die on Machine World, just like we were supposed to. But afterward, if by some miracle I wasn't permed, I wouldn't forget we'd been abandoned.
Chapter 43. It turned out in the end that there were 7 ships approaching Machine World. They were Imperial Capital ships, the same design as Minotaur and Cyclops. That's why Turov had pulled out. In a way, I couldn't blame her for that part. She had 2 ships, 2 sets of 16 broadsides. Even if she'd wanted to tangle with these interlopers, she would be facing 7-2 odds. There was no path to victory for Earth when our ships were outnumbered so badly. What I wasn't happy about was being dumped on this ice ball and left to the slaughter. Turov had chosen to leave a garrison and pull out. Legion Varus was going to have to face the enemy alone. Fortunately for me, I didn't have time to think about any of these unpleasant details when the lifter opened up and disgorged our dragons onto the steep slopes of Titan, which was what we'd named this mountain over the last week or so. "All right, listen up," Graves said in my ear as I rushed my people out into the snow. "We'll start this by stealing a page from the squid playbook. We're going to get everyone inside the mines. We'll hide in there to keep the enemy guessing as to our full strength and composition. In the meantime, if they choose to bombard us, we'll be reasonably safe. Ha! Carlos said after Graves dropped out of the channel. The squid playbook. Look how well it worked out for the squids. I had to admit he had a point there, but I couldn't openly agree with him on the chat channel, and besides, it was probably the best move we could make. Shut up in the ranks, I said. Dragons, form a wedge. We'll stand guard at the entrance to the mine and cover the infantry as they get out of their drop pods and try to reach safety.
What if they start dropping bombs on us? Carlos demanded.
Then we'll run over the infantry stragglers to get into the mines. These dragon vehicles are more valuable than our flesh. Remember that. You are expendable, but your vehicle isn't.
There was grumbling, but it was nothing they hadn't heard before. No one in a real fighting legion was uncertain about their lack of personal value to the Empire or to Earth. We stood outside in the hazy cold, watching troops struggling through the snow from every direction to the mouth of the mines. Thousands of them came in knots and bunches. No one ordered them to form ranks and columns to make an organized march of it. Commanders didn't know how long we had, and after the drop, the troops were scattered to hell and back anyway. In my dragon, I kept one eye on the gray skies. It was pretty pointless to do so, of course. If the big invading ships rolled into orbit overhead, we probably wouldn't see them from the ground in the daylight. If the ship did park on top of us and fire their broadsides, we would only be treated to a few seconds of brilliant falling stars. After that, everything for kilometers around would vanish as the fusion shells landed. But I still found myself gazing up at the sky, and the rest of my squad mates were doing the same. A channel request beeped, and I opened it without looking to see who it was.
McGill here, go ahead.
You think they're up there?
Asked Harris's voice in my helmet.
They say seven Imperial dropships, same as ours. What in the fuck is that about? Who would have the balls to send troops out here to try to kick us off this planet?
That was the real question we all had swimming in our heads. Harris had finally voiced it. What the hell was going on? Who was attacking us? This wasn't supposed to happen. Sure, there were squids and there were the pissed-off Nerbs, but how could either of them have brought in a force in response so quickly?
I don't know, Vet, I said. Could the squids have copied our designs?
I'd vote no on that theory. I've heard it before. Leeson seems convinced these ships are squid counterfeits built to freak us out. But that just doesn't seem right.
Agreed, I said. I don't think it's the squids. Copying another culture? No, that's not their style. They're too arrogant for that.
Then we're in agreement. It has to be the Nerbs. They came to have a little show trial. And then, when that didn't go the way they wanted, they called in backup.
I frowned inside my helmet and turned toward him. He was standing with his own squad about 100 meters to the west. We were guarding both sides of this particular entrance to the mines. In between our two squads, a steady stream of infantry trotted over trampled snow, puffing with exertion. He was looking back at me, but he was too far away for me to read his expression.
"Is that what you think?" I demanded over our radio link. "That my trial with the Nerbs triggered all this?"
Well, why shouldn't I think that, McGill? It wouldn't be the first time you screwed up and changed the fate of the human race now, would it?
I heaved a sigh and I almost closed the channel. Harris might have finally broken down enough to shake my hand and welcome me into the ranks of the Varus Veteran Society, but he still had a grudge going. I was the source of all evil in his eyes. Looking up, I saw something I hadn't expected to see.
Harris, I think we're going to have the answer to your questions sooner rather than later.
Why's that, McGill?
Because they're dropping troops. Drop pods incoming, thousands of them. By God, they look like stones falling from the sky.
Everyone was looking up. Some of the troops paused to squint and point before running faster for the entrance. I added Leeson to our channel.
I think we should hit them before they get their act together, sir, I said.
What? Demanded Harris. Don't hit them, fool. Adjunct Leeson, sir, these capsules must be more troops from Solstice, that's all.
No, Vet, I said. I have it on good authority our ships have pulled out. They're fleeing the system even now. There's no way Turov would have turned around to come back and drop another legion. Do I have permission, Adjunct? Leeson was inside the mines and couldn't see the situation out on the slopes.
Command your men and fight your dragons, McGill. I'll bring the rest of the platoon out there in a few minutes. Leeson out.
He dropped the channel, and I was left watching the first capsules as they struck the ground.
McGill, Harris said to me privately, don't you go off and do something stupid now, do you hear?
I cut him off.
Squad, limber up! We're advancing down slope!
My people had been lounging, but they perked up quickly when I gave the word. My squad was smaller now that I'd lost Della and the rest of Harris's people, but I'd gained Sargon and every one of our dragons was in prime fighting condition.
Work your battle computers, I said. Filter out the troops that are already on the ground from those dropping. Mark the new arrivals as hostile until we know the score.
By the time I deployed down slope, Leeson came thundering out with another full platoon. Graves and even Winslade himself followed with more dragons. Our questions concerning the nature of our new arrivals were answered almost immediately. Firefights broke out in a dozen places all around. Our infantry were caught up in a dozen small gun battles with the invaders. They were definitely not friendly.
"Which squad has anti-air cannons on their backs?" Winslade demanded.
A squad from another platoon reported that they did, and Winslade ordered them to shoot down every pod they could get a bead on. Almost immediately, small missiles created plumes of gas and flame. Missiles streaked up to meet the drop pods. 100 of the pods were converted into fireballs before they reached the mountainside. The troops who'd been trotting for the mine entrance now became a fleeing mob. Their only orders were to get under cover since they didn't have any weaponry that could shoot down a falling drop pod. Our AA cannons missed as many drop pods as they hit, and they kept on coming down. Soon, enemy infantry were climbing out of the pods all around us. Some were kilometers off, others were right in our faces. The troops, at first, I didn't know what to make of them. They were physically larger than men, about 2 meters tall and bulky. They stood as dark, humanoid hulks outlined against the snow. They had heavy projection weapons, and they wore armor. We faced a heavy cohort, but not a human one. Then I saw the tails, and I knew.
"Saurians!"
I shouted over the unichannel.
"Sirs, they're Saurian troops! No juggers, just basic raptors!"
"We figured that out, McGill," Graves answered. "The enemy are Saurians from Steel World. They're not authorized to breathe on this planet. We're going to correct the error."
"What's that mean?"
Sargon asked.
"That means we're supposed to kill all the lizards, you big moron,"
Carlos said. I winced when I heard that. Sargon wouldn't do anything now in the midst of battle, but there was sure to be a fresh ass-whooping waiting for Carlos after this was over. Some people never learned.
"Squad, we haven't got an AA," I said. "We're going to use our spinal cannons to blast any group of Saurians that gets their act together and forms a cohesive force."
It didn't take long. After about 3 minutes of total confusion, our troops stopped streaming into the mine. The rest that were still out on the slopes had either been shot or were pinned in defensive positions by the enemy. The steady drumbeat of drop pods from above showed no signs of letting up. We soon identified organized groups of Saurians who had formed up, taken cover, and now were laying fire down on our position. My team had gone with heavy armament as our mission this time out was supposed to be a defensive one, not a fast-moving recon effort. Our loadout choices paid dividends today as I ordered my squad to switch on their shields and fire their heavy guns at enemy concentrations. Troops melted away under fragmentation shells. Rarely a group of Saurians charged in to close with us, but we repelled them with grenade fire at point-blank range. As we fought, organized Varus infantry came out to help. Centurions led them, and soon a full unit was supporting every squad of dragons. The Saurians soon figured out they weren't going to take us out with an all-out wave assault. Surprise had helped them initially, and we'd lost a lot of men and dragons out on the slopes. But these gains were easily balanced by the carnage our dragons reaped against their unsupported attacks. It was a slaughter, and my squad only lost 3 machines while killing several hundred attacking troops. Finally, the Saurians pulled back. The drop pods no longer came down directly on top of us. When new arrivals climbed out of their pods, they ran away, disappearing over the folds of the mountain. When it grew dark, we retreated as well. We posted guards at the mine entrance, and my squad was relieved. We walked our creaking dragons into the caverns and got out of them, aching and complaining. "You did well out there, team," I said. "I didn't see a single mistake. Well done, well fought." My troops beamed and clapped one another on the back. One clap came down a little too hard on Carlos, however.
"What the fu-"
Carlos demanded. His voice was cut off by a pair of huge hands that encircled his windpipe and began squeezing. Carlos looked at me plaintively. I looked at him and his assailant. Then I nodded to Sargon. "Proceed, specialist," I said. Sargon beat on the smaller man for a full minute. Carlos got in a few good licks. He always did. Sargon looked surprised when his genitals took a hard yanking, for example. I could have told him to look out for that one. But in the end, Carlos was down on the ground, heaving, crawling, and puking. I sipped a hot cup of caff and pretended I hadn't seen anything. Sometimes the life of a veteran-ranked non-com had its little rewards. Chapter 44. By morning the next day, we were surrounded by around 60,000 Saurian troops. They were crawling all over the mountaintop. Some were above the mines, and some were below us, maneuvering along the ridges and escarpments, hugging stone and ice for cover. A siege had begun, and without support from space, we had no way of knowing what the enemy was up to. Our buzzers had managed to count the enemy troops, but that was all. The tiny spy drones were being caught and destroyed as fast as we could send them out. After a sleepless night of barricading the mine entrances, the officers were busy filing our unit's after-action reports with Winslade, and I'd been repairing our dragons. We kicked off our platoon's morning briefing at 10 a.m. sharp.
60,000!
Leeson marveled when we were done with the boring parts. He gave a long, low whistle that made me clench my teeth. Sometimes when a whistle comes in through sensitive headphones, it's pretty annoying. "They say they had 70,000 when they first dropped," I pointed out.
"That's right," Leeson said, pointing a gauntleted finger at me. "You boys did well. Altogether, our anti-air fire combined with our quick counterattack cost them dearly. Their initial assault was meant to catch us by surprise, but it was an utter failure. They lost the equivalent of a full legion. Just think of it."
"A lot of those were splats, sir,"
Sargon pointed out. Leeson shot him an unhappy look. I caught that, and I think Sargon did, too. He shut up in a hurry.
"Sure, sure," Leeson said. "Half those deaths were due to splats, I'll admit that. The lizards are new to this game. I bet not one of their troops had ever crawled out of a pod into a firefight before, but we gunned down 5,000, we estimate. That's astounding."
Leeson sounded excited, bloodthirsty even, but I had to feel a small pang for the lizards that had died yesterday. They'd fought well and fearlessly. The question to my mind, and everyone else's, was why they'd come here to fight us at all. Leeson thought he had an answer for that.
"The best part is these clowns will all be permed for this. They've overreached this time. They're obviously trying to stop Earth from grabbing a competing source of metals. Hell, their entire sweatbox of a planet might not survive once the Nerves pass their judgment."
I wasn't so sure about that, but I didn't want to go up against my commander in an argument that was pointless. If this had been a matter of tactics and survival, sure, I'd speak my piece. But not when we were talking about whether something was true or not. Truth had a way of sorting itself out in time, and yapping about it never changed the answer.
"We whooped them," Leeson continued. "That's what it comes down to. And when they come into these tunnels to dig us out, we'll smash them down again. They don't have a chance."
A few ragged cheers went up from the group. Suddenly it dawned on me what Adjunct Leeson was doing. He was trying to build up morale. Seen in that light, his rhetoric suddenly made good sense. These people needed a pep talk. Anyone with half a brain could see we were all totally screwed. that we were going to die in this hole like it was the biggest warren full of rats in history, but it was equally undeniable that troops with hope fought harder. Accordingly, I stood up and banged my gauntlets together. Harris joined in immediately. Sargon looked startled, but then he stood up with us. He was still walking funny after yesterday's encounter with Carlos, but he was game. I'd noticed that Sargon was doing everything Harris and I did lately, trying to support us. As a man bucking for rank, that made good sense. In contrast, my methods to achieve promotions were unconventional and even accidental. Graves joined the group, and the applause grew louder. We stared around the team flatly, then nodded when we'd quieted.
"That was well done yesterday," he said. "Our defensive rearguard action helped get as much equipment off those slopes and into the mountain as possible. As far as I'm concerned, we accomplished that mission."
That was vintage Graves. Lives, deaths, those meant nothing. Hardware was what he cared about. In his calculus of war, our blood meant about as much as our spit, and probably a lot less. We had more blood in us than we did spit, after all. He went on to talk about deployments, defensive preparations, and supply rationing. After the meeting, we broke up and were assigned specific duties. As my team had taken losses in battle yesterday, we were spared guard duty. I told everyone to go on break and relax, but to keep their dragons ready to roll. We could get called back to the front lines any minute.
"Hey, McGill," said a gravelly voice.
I turned to see Carlos. He was in pretty bad shape. His right eye was swollen shut and his lips were split and as red as raw meat.
"Ouch," I said. "You fit to fight, soldier?" "You challenging me again, vet?"
"No," I chuckled. "What's up? And why haven't you gone to the infirmary to get some skin sprayed over that?"
"It's no big deal. I've been too busy."
"Doing what?"
He smiled, and the blood that outlined his teeth made me squinch up my eyes. "Kiwi, for one thing. She thought it was cool that I stood up for my rights with Sargon."
"Did she hear what you said to him to get your ass whooped?"
"No, and don't tell her about that part, okay? She thinks I was a total victim."
"Don't worry," I assured him. "I think you've paid enough for that mistake already."
"Okay, cool. Let's go."
"Go where?"
"I've got something to show you, vet. I guarantee you're going to like it."
Figuring I didn't have much to lose, I followed him as he walked painfully down into the guts of the mountain. I was expecting more vids of squids on their homeworlds, or possibly another giant squid in a tank. What I got was something entirely different. The mines themselves were largely unexplored. We checked out the upper levels, where there were smelters and transportation systems for ore and titanium bricks, but we hadn't spent much time in the lower tunnels where the actual mining had been done. Carlos led me deep into the uncharted depths.
"Here is the limit,"
Carlos said, pointing down into a dark shaft that led downward at a 30-degree angle.
"This is about as far as anyone has ever been in Mount Titan."
"That's because the rest of the mine is empty," I pointed out.
"No, not entirely. Kiwi and I found some equipment down there, more stuff that belonged to the squids."
"Why mess with that?"
"What are you, stoop?"
He began, but stopped himself, taking a breath. That was possibly the first time I'd ever seen him edit himself. Carlos always insulted people who were bigger than he was. Hell, that behavior was practically stamped in his DNA. He shook his finger at me, and his split lips parted into a ghastly grin.
"No. No way. Not this time. I'm not giving you another excuse. Not so soon."
"Just tell me why you brought me down here."
"Look, the squids had the native machines working for them, right?"
he asked. "Yes, seems like they did."
"And therefore, they had to have a way to tell the machines what to do, didn't they?"
I thought about it. After a few seconds, I nodded. "That stands to reason."
"Exactly. And let me tell you one of the prime rules of tech development. If it's already invented, copy someone else's work. Don't invent your own. It's much easier that way."
I chuckled. "All right, then. Did you find a translation device?"
"We did. We found something that appears to be a communication system. Unfortunately, we can't get it to work yet.
Frowning, I turned that statement over in my mind. He led me into a large, dark chamber. There, deep in the guts of the mountain, was a strange workshop. Something was down there. Something that moved. That's when the light went on in my head. You aren't telling me you've got one of the native machine creatures down here, are you?
Yep. How else could we be testing the translation system?
That was what I'd been thinking about.
When you said you hadn't got it to work yet, I was wondering how you would know if it was working at all. This little guy, he's the answer. Only he's not talking.
Carlos approached a small native machine creature. It was one of the young that I'd met up with back along the river and had a drawing contest with. He was a few meters long and about half a meter thick. Like a metal caterpillar, he wormed his way over the stony floor, making scrabbling sounds. There was a chain welded to his carapace, and burn marks all around the chain.
"We had a hell of a time getting him under control," Carlos said. "We've spent all last night trying to get this moron to talk, but no dice. He might be a dud."
He gave the machine a kick, and it humped and scrambled away to the limits of its chain, which wasn't very far.
"Have you been abusing this thing?"
I asked, frowning.
"Abusing it? Sure. Whatever works, but nothing does. We've tried to tell it to eat, to turn around, to play dead. We've worked this translation box 16 different ways, and this dipshit..."
He moved to give the machine another kick, but I grabbed him and gave him a shaking instead. I wanted to do more, but he was pretty well beat up already.
"Carlos," I said, controlling myself. "I think someone with a gentler hand might do better." "That's what Kiwi said. That's why I brought you down here. But James, please, if you do get him to talk, you've got to let us have some of the glory. Don't hog it all, okay? I didn't even tell Kiwi I was going to show you. She doesn't trust you at all."
"Don't worry." To start with, I drew pictures. The machine looked at them, but didn't dare draw its own. It had been traumatized. It shook and squirmed, but wouldn't draw a damn thing in response.
"How much did you beat on him?" I demanded. "Hardly any," Carlos said. "Okay, maybe a little. But I don't think it was us. I think it was the squids who really did a number on him. See his tail section and his undercarriage? There are burn marks and dents everywhere. Maybe he wouldn't work, so they tortured him."
"I'm glad that wasn't all you," I said. I spent several hours with the little machine that day. I even took out titanium shavings and fed them to him. That got him interested. After a while, I came up with a plan. "He's not going to communicate out of curiosity," I said. "We've got to get him to cooperate with rewards."
"And punishments?"
"No, just the withholding of rewards." Carlos heaved a sigh.
"Sounds slow."
"Go get me a bag of titanium shavings. I'm going to run out." He left, and I tried my best. I drew simple shapes, then fed a shaving to the machine when I showed him a circle, for instance. The machine studied it, ate the shaving, but that was about it. I began to think maybe we did have a dud, like Carlos had said, but I kept at it. After drawing the same circle, feeding it a shaving, then erasing the circle and drawing it again about four times, I stopped feeding the machine and began to pretend to feed myself. Each time I pretended to eat a shaving, I drew a square instead of a circle on the ground. The machine watched raptly as I did this. I slowly drew the square and fed myself another, then another. The machine watched me move chip after chip up to my faceplate. I secretly dropped them into a fold of my suit, then took another out of the bag. Finally, the machine lost it. The poor thing was starved. He scuttled forward and erased the square I'd drawn and scratched out a circle with his feet. As with the first machine I'd managed to contact, his circle was perfectly round. I promptly fed him a shaving. We had made a breakthrough. Circles meant the machine was fed. Squares meant I was fed. We had a language of our own. By the time Carlos returned with a fresh bag of shavings for the machine, we were drawing things back and forth. I would draw a shape, then it would draw the same thing, only better than my version. Then I would feed him a shaving. The machine backed away when Carlos came near, and I pushed Carlos back. "He doesn't trust you," I said. "Stay over there." Eventually, Kiwi showed up. She was pissed off immediately.
"You brought McGill down here?" she demanded. "We've been working on making a breakthrough ever since we first posted on the planet, and you're going to let him show it to the brass and take all the credit again, aren't you?"
"I'm just drawing things," I said. "Relax, Kiwi."
"No girl can relax around you," she said.
I gave her a glance, then shrugged. She was glaring at me. She might have heard about my recent dating activity with Anne. That was typical for Kiwi. She'd carry on with other men, but when I dated a new girl, she may or may not display a fit of jealousy. If she was in the mood, she'd get mad at everything I did without bringing up what was really bothering her. I guess that came with the territory when you had an on-again, off-again relationship with a girl. Eventually, I had the machine performing a wide range of tricks. I even managed to have a primitive conversation with it. We'd established that the squids and the machines were interacting, but when this little guy drew the squids, it was with a chain connected to the machines. He didn't seem to be under any illusions. The machines were slaves to the squids, not friends or allies. "It makes sense," I said. "The squids consider themselves conquerors. They enslave creatures and alter them. Back on Dust World, they did it with humans. Here, they've been doing it with these machines. I wonder if these machines have been altered in design to better meet the squid requirements."
"That would be easier than doing it with selective breeding, you would think," Kiwi said.
"Yeah, maybe. But we don't even know how these creatures reproduce yet."
"Why don't you draw two machines screwing?" Carlos asked. "Maybe that will jog the little pervert's mind."
"You're the pervert," Kiwi said.
"You should know."
I had to step in before Carlos got himself punched again by Kiwi this time. "Okay, okay, that's enough. Let's stay on task. How does this translation box you stole from the squids work?" They showed me an odd device. It wasn't entirely made of metal. Parts of it were slimy, like gelatin or thick, pasty oil. When you rubbed it in various ways, the thing produced odd rasping sounds. The machine took note when we worked the interface, but didn't respond in any sensible way. "How the hell are we supposed to figure out what this device is saying?" I asked.
"Now you know why we're still working on this," Kiwi said.
"We should probably bring Natasha in at this point. You guys probably should have as soon as you found this thing. She's better at this stuff than I am."
"No!" Kiwi shouted. "You promised, James. Natasha will hog everything."
"Look," I said, "we might be able to get help from the machines if we figured this out. Isn't that more important than a promotion?"
"Not really,"
Kiwi said stubbornly.
"You've already got rank, James. This is our best shot."
"But we might all die down here," I said. "The Saurians are going to attack, and they outnumber us 6-1.
"Leeson said they'll get trashed if they try to come in here," Carlos said.
"And you believed him?"
"No, not really," he admitted.
He turned to Kiwi, looking disappointed.
"He might be right, Kiwi. We failed."
"I know what this is about," Kiwi said with sudden anger. "You're just trying to make Natasha happy again. She found out about Della and Anne, didn't she?"
I heaved a sigh and walked out of the tunnel. "I'll be back in about an hour," I said. "If you can make it talk by then, you'll get full credit. Have at it." I left them behind, cursing my name. When I returned with Natasha, it was a full 90 minutes later. Kiwi was there, but Carlos was gone. So was the machine. "What happened?" I asked, shaking my head.
"We tried everything," Kiwi said. "We were desperate. Carlos thought this was the last chance we had to get credit for the discovery." "You guys are crazy," Natasha said. "Kiwi, you just have to go through the training and show aptitude. When a slot opens up and your skill level is high, you'll get it. Advancement isn't always about showing off for brass." "Oh, yeah? Is that why McGill, the biggest screw-up in the Legion, is 2 ranks above us? And what about Winslade? Are you telling me he's not a royal kiss-up?
She had us there, so Natasha stopped arguing. She examined the squid translation box. I'd honestly assumed that when she checked it out, she'd pronounce it to be a squid masturbation aid or something like that. But she didn't.
I think this is a translation system. It produces sounds like a machine. The interface is strange, but not unlike those that I've seen before. Now, why did you let the machine go, Kiwi? Like I said, we were getting desperate. The machine wasn't reacting much, other than to draw a few shapes on the ground. We finally realized that it was drawing things that matched the noises the translator was making.
Ah, I said, catching on. Did you feed it titanium shavings?
Yes, once we figured it out.
Together, Natasha and I examined the drawings. There were dozens of them.
Did you record this?
Natasha asked. Do we have data to analyze?
Yes, Kiwi said. I'm not an idiot.
But what happened to Carlos? I demanded. Kiwi looked down, ashamed.
We ran out of room on the floor. It was at the limits of its chain. We decided to cut the chain to let it have more space. We figured it would stay because we were feeding it titanium.
Let me guess, I said. The second you cut the chain, it took off.
Not exactly. It waited until we ran out of chips.
I rolled my eyes. So Carlos is chasing after it.
I made him go. It was his stupid idea to cut the chain in the first place.
All right. I'd better go find him, I said. I left the two women going over the remaining data. Kiwi had meticulously recorded the interactions, matching sounds and drawings. She also had many vids of past efforts to communicate, which she grudgingly passed over to Natasha's tapper. I was happy to see them working together. Natasha was wisely heaping Kiwi with praise, and Kiwi's mistrust seemed to be melting. The trail left behind by Carlos and the chain-dragging machine wasn't difficult to follow. I found them less than a kilometer farther down in the tunnels. Unfortunately, the scene wasn't a happy one. Carlos was dead, with his faceplate cracked open. He'd asphyxiated. The machine was perched on his chest, feasting on the metal bits in his suit. Chapter 45. The disastrous result of our communication attempts was probably a good lesson for me. I'd come to think of the machines, the small, young ones at least, as harmless. But they weren't. They were like wild animal cubs. It was so easy to forget they were predatory creatures. Just like any lion cub or bear cub, they'd eat you if they could. I almost killed the machine. It would have been fairly easy to do. Unlike Carlos, I had a heavy beamer on me. I unslung it and aimed it at the head section of the animal. That's how I thought of these machines now, as semi-intelligent animals. But I didn't fire. The baby machine didn't flee. Instead, it made a rasping sound. It might have been growling, telling me to get lost. A large number of its cameras studied me, and it kept on chewing while it did so. The machine was feeding, but it wasn't eating Carlos. That would have been too much for me. It was eating his suit. That's all it had wanted, after all. The poor thing had been starved and abused for who knew how long down here in these tunnels. I could hardly expect civilized discourse after the squids and Carlos had kept it on a chain. Would it be possible to negotiate with these creatures later, when we weren't fighting over who was going to steal their resources? Maybe. One thing was for sure, killing them for eating metal wouldn't help bring peace. All right, I said, stepping closer and prodding at its hindquarters. I'm not going to hurt you, but you have to move on. Scram! The machine was unconvinced. It rasped and whirled at me threateningly. It was like a feral dog snarling over a carcass. I gave it a kick and it tried to bite my foot. I knew as long as I didn't let it get to my faceplate, I was going to be all right. The thing hadn't killed Carlos directly. His faceplate had cracked and the air was poisonous, which was the only reason he'd succumbed. But I couldn't very well let it chew on Carlos's air tanks forever. That was just going to teach it the wrong thing. so I cranked down the power level on my weapon and gave it a jolt in the butt, just enough to spot-weld its hind plates together. It didn't like that at all. It lunged at me, and I zapped it twice more. Finally, the creature got the message and ran off into the dark tunnels. Grabbing Carlos by the collar, I dragged him back to the chamber where Natasha had been working with Kiwi. They looked at Carlos in horror, but they didn't seem all that surprised. "I've got the data off his tapper," I said. "He'll catch a revive when I report his death to the bio people."
"Did you kill the machine?" Natasha asked.
"No, it wasn't really at fault. The poor thing was only hungry." Natasha looked worried, as did Kiwi. "What's up?" I asked.
"I don't know if allowing it to escape was a good idea," Natasha said. "I've been examining the vids of the communication attempts made by Carlos and Kiwi. At the end of them, the machine clearly understood something they said. That's when it ran off."
"So something you communicated made it flee?"
"We think so," Kiwi admitted. "Whatever it was," Natasha said, "I'm certain Carlos and Kiwi managed to give the machine a coherent message, but I'm not sure what was said."
"That's just grand," I said, giving Kiwi a scowl. "Let's hope he didn't tell them they could all go to hell in a handbasket."
"It could have been anything," Kiwi said defensively. "Why are you two assuming the worst?" "Whatever the message was, it can't be good," Natasha said. "It clearly triggered aggression."
Kiwi looked worried, but she shrugged rather than apologizing. "Do you need to keep working here, Natasha?" I asked.
"No. Without the machine, this particular spot has no special significance. I can take the device with me and review the data anywhere."
"Then let's get back up to the main camp. I need to report Carlos's death anyway." We trudged up the tunnels, dragging Carlos's body the whole way. It occurred to me that in times past, a fallen soldier had been treated with great respect and honor. Those days were gone. A body was just a body in my time. We recycled them as fast as possible, sometimes burying them in mass graves or even burning a stack to get rid of them physically. The equipment was what we really needed. The dead were only useful as raw materials for a new body if supplies were short and the corpse was fresh enough. After delivering Carlos's body to the bio people, who wrinkled their noses and hauled it dutifully away, I returned to my unit's camp. I relayed my findings to Graves, including our previous discoveries of oversized squids and the data globe. He ordered me to talk to Winslade about everything. Sighing, I walked up gritty ramps and tunnels to the lofty caverns high up in the mountain's guts. I hadn't wanted to do this. I'd planned to let Kiwi and Carlos get their act together and make the report themselves, thus garnering the credit. But in my opinion, the situation had changed. We were encircled by enemies and in danger. Secrets withheld from our commanders might get us all permed. I had the duty to report everything we'd found. In Mount Titan's highest chambers, I found Winslade's makeshift office. That's where all the officers held court. Winslade had chosen a pretty spot, complete with a trickling fall of silvery liquid methane and stalagmites that resembled dragon fangs coming up from the floor. He pressurized the entire chamber and warmed it up, so we didn't have to wear helmets in here. That's why the methane was melting. Despite Winslade's efforts, it still smelled too farty for my taste, so I kept my faceplate closed. "Nice quarters, sir," I commented. Winslade turned to look at me. He didn't have a smile on his face. He rarely did.
"Veteran, what's this I hear from Graves about you performing unauthorized diplomatic negotiations again?"
I was taken aback. Winslade was referring to certain activities I'd performed years ago on Dust World when I'd tried to communicate with the local population of colonists. "I don't know about any negotiations, sir," I said. "We found one of the machines chained up in a lower tunnel, along with a lot of unknown squid equipment. We fooled around with it a bit, but we didn't get very far. The machine ran off." Winslade narrowed his eyes. He was a cagey one, as slime balls go. I had to wonder what he was thinking. The question I was hoping he didn't ask was who the we in my statement might consist of.
I knew Carlos and Kiwi were trying hard to get some positive recognition, and I didn't want to take that from them. But I also didn't want to involve them unless things went the right way. At the moment, the whole thing looked like a disaster, so I figured I might as well take the blame myself. People expected this kind of thing from James McGill.
"Up to your usual tricks," Winslade said at last. "This is my first time playing the role of your commander, and I must say I'm sympathizing with all those who've done so before me. You even managed to get one of your troops killed, correct?"
"Not exactly, sir. In any case, we did recover his full kit. He'll pop right out of the revival machine as fit as a fiddle in an hour or so."
Winslade nodded. "I would seek disciplinary action, but your fighting skills are desperately needed at this time. When the Saurians first attacked, you did well, by every report."
"Thank you, Primus."
Winslade gave me a wry look, indicating he hadn't intended to praise me. "Dismissed," he said.
I hesitated until he looked up at me with his eyebrows raised. Then I asked another question.
"Sir, is Drusus up and walking around yet?" "Yes, the Tribune's revival has finally been achieved. Whatever technical difficulty kept him from returning to us has been solved."
I almost laughed at that. Winslade knew full well that Turov had ordered Drusus to be kept on ice until she said otherwise. Now that she'd dumped the Legion on this rock and fled the star system, sure, it was time to revive poor old Drusus. Why not let him die again down here like the rest of us?
"You mind if I give my report to him, sir?" I asked. "I don't see why it would be necessary."
Well, you may not be aware that Drusus and I have a standing arrangement when special circumstances like this come up. He wants a full report from the man in the field when matters go beyond the norm and enter the political arena."
Winslade's frown was back. "Is this some kind of threat, veteran?"
"Not at all, sir. You misunderstand. I'm informing you of a special relationship between myself and the Tribune, that's all. It's similar in nature to the relationship you've enjoyed for years with Imperator Turov. Your permission, sir?"
Winslade huffed. "Sounds like you don't need my permission, but I suppose it was courteous to ask. Suddenly, your rapid rise in rank is less surprising to me."
"Thank you, sir," I said, and left. I could have said a lot more, and I wanted to. Right off, Winslade had assumed my promotions were illegitimate, since his were. I resented that. He'd been flying a desk for the last decade, hassling attractive underlings and kissing Turov's shapely butt. He'd leapt to the conclusion that I was doing the same thing with Drusus as my patron. It wasn't true. But I knew it wouldn't do any good to try to defend myself in the eyes of this man. Drusus's office was less secluded and more utilitarian. He was just outside the general officer's camp, with a standard-issue computer desk and displays encircling the small chamber. He was studying three-dimensional tactical grids that presented the enemy positions around the mountain outside.
"Ah, McGill," he said, glancing at me. "I was wondering when you would come to haunt me again."
"Sorry, sir," I said. "It's just my way."
"Understood. What alarming news do you have for me today?"
Drusus had a lot of catching up to do, so I started at the beginning. I told him about my first contact with the native machine life. I also discussed and displayed vids of the dead giant squid and the data globe we discovered. He expressed mild interest in all these things and promised he'd have teams of techs go over them. Then I brought him up to speed on each of the incidents of communication with the machine creatures at the present time. As I explained this, I made an effort to play up the efforts of Kiwi and Carlos in the best possible light.
I'm unsurprised about Kiwi's contribution. But Carlos Ortiz?
He asked, as if unfamiliar with the name. He frowned and worked his tapper.
Oh, yes. A regular with behavioral problems.
Same as I used to be, sir, I said, a few years back.
Drusus laughed. According to your superiors, little about your aptitude for getting into trouble has changed.
If you say so, sir.
But Carlos does deserve credit for getting the machines to talk using the alien translating equipment. He also discovered and did the initial work with the data globe. Drusus made a dismissive wave. That's not how things look to me, McGill. Let me explain how an officer of many years sees these reports. The regular known as Keevy accompanied Ortiz on every occasion. When breakthroughs were recently made, you